You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll meet a competitive jump rope team from Wisconsin. First, Wisconsin's primary elections are in 2 months, and voters have a lot to decide on. There's a heated race between two Republicans looking to challenge Senator Tammy Baldwin, and a group of 10 Democrats are fighting for a chance to take on Governor Walker. The Marquette University Law School poll has been gauging where voters stand on this year's races and a number of other issues. The newest results came out earlier today. Charles Franklin is with us now. He is the director of the Marquette University Law School poll and a professor of law and public policy at Marquette. Charles, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here.
Well, I picked out a theme in these election ones. You've got the two Republicans running against Tammy Baldwin, 10 Democrats running to race for governor. The general consensus seems to be who?
That's exactly right. And I think more than just that fact, it's important to put everything else in that context when we look at the horse race and so on, is to appreciate how little voters have yet tuned in. The best-known candidate is still unknown to 61% of voters, and it's higher for the other 9 Democrats and for the 2 Republicans in the Senate contest. And that's not completely shocking, even though it's only 2 months away. The campaigns really haven't ramped up. They're not, for the most part, doing TV advertising. And so we have a ways to go. But it means that a lot of people don't know these candidates yet. 34% of Democratic primary voters say they don't know who they'd vote for. 30% of Republican primary voters don't know. So in light of lack of familiarity and high don't know rates in these races, I think it's important to say these are races that could still develop pretty dramatically if a candidate gets a sudden advantage or breaks out in some way.
I'll throw a hypothesis at you, Charles. Tell me what you think about it. Is this a case where for a lot of these voters, for the Democrats, they're thinking, hey, whoever we got, I'll vote for them over Walker. I don't need to worry about which one it is at this point. Same thing maybe for Republicans in the Senate race. They're not going to vote for Tammy Baldwin. They're going to vote for the person with the R by the name.
Right. I think that is true, and it's especially true in the governor's race, where opinions about Walker have been so polarized for so long. And through 3 elections, now 4, counting the recall. So Walker gets a pretty consistent mid-40s to high 40s vote when we match them against every one of the 10 Democrats. And the Democrats themselves range from about 38 to about 44 for most of the candidates. So really, that's like saying, are you going to vote for a Democrat or are you going to vote for Scott Walker? And there's just not a whole lot of variation from candidate to candidate. And that makes sense when you realize how little known these candidates are still.
All that said, let's key in on each of these primary races. Let's start with the race for governor. You got 10 candidates trying to stand out from the field over the course of the next handful of weeks. When you poll people on the Democratic primary itself, what do you find?
So this is based on people who say they will vote in the Democratic primary. Tony Evers stands out at 25%. He's the only Democratic candidate that's in double digits. Then we have 3 at 7%. That's Flynn and McCabe and Soglin. And then everybody else is at 5 points or lower. One that bears noting is Kel DeRoys, who won the straw poll at the Democratic convention, but we don't see much of a bounce for her, and later we didn't see a bounce for Leah Vukmir, who won the Republican Party endorsement. So neither convention seems to have really helped candidates break out from the field.
Are we so keyed into national politics and national news, there's a lot of it, that maybe it's taking the air out of the room for these primary candidates?
Well, I think the intensity of national politics, at least if you follow politics closely, is kind of overwhelming right now. But I also think this is a function of a 10-candidate field on the Democratic side. It's very hard when you spread resources, news coverage, media events so thinly across them, it makes it hard for one to break out. Now, the positive side for those that are below 10% right now is that Evers at 25% is certainly not a commanding margin. And if something should move support to one particular candidate, they could move out. Having said all of that, on the Republican side, both candidates are relatively little known, and there are only two candidates on that Senate race. And so this is more than just the big field. I think it is national politics, and it's also that even though it's June, it's not late July yet, and people haven't tuned in.
Talking to Charles Franklin from the Marquette University Law School poll, new results out earlier today. We're checking them out. Charles, a lot of talk about this idea of, hey, is there a blue wave in Wisconsin, around the country? You tried to gauge voter enthusiasm on both sides and for independents. What did you find?
Right. So we asked, how enthusiastic are you? And back in early March, when we asked this in the last time, Democrats were 64% very enthusiastic and Republicans 54%. So that was a 10-point Democratic advantage. Both groups have gotten more enthused since, but Republicans have closed the gap. Democrats have gone up to 71% very enthusiastic, but Republicans have bumped up to 67%. So now what was a 10-point Democratic advantage is only about a 4-point advantage. One of the things I said when we released the results today is this is a measure that historically has moved around quite a bit. People seem sensitive to short-term events. And so I think we might expect this measure to move over the course of the year. The question is, does one party maintain an advantage even if it varies, or do we see the gap close or even reverse?
Now, you were in the field before this family separation immigration issue really heated up. I mean, it was starting, I think, to come up. Can an issue like that swing people one way or another?
I think it can, but the question is how long and sustained is the issue? The intensity of the issue over the last 3 or 4 or 5 days has been really extraordinary. And I think if that were maintained for a month, we might see some really major effects. I think the question now with the president changing the policy that his administration chose to implement is whether that does diffuse the issue or whether the 2,000 or more children who are currently separated from parents can be matched back with their parents, or whether we have a second phase in which the issue lingers if it turns out that Homeland Security is actually unable to reunite families. That would be a follow-on consequence of this policy over the last month or so.
One issue you checked out that's been in national news with impacts on Wisconsin, the administration's tariffs on steel and aluminum. What do Wisconsin voters think about those?
And this is interesting because it's a place where support for tariffs or positive views of tariffs is quite low. Only 29% think tariffs will help the economy. 55% think it will hurt the economy. And also we asked about free trade in general. 51% said free trade agreements have been good for the U.S. economy. Only 28% said bad. So this is a case where two issues that Trump has embraced, he's embraced on the substantial minority opinion. Now, we know that Trump's supporters are very intense on this issue, but it still leaves quite a gap between his overall support, which is 44% in this poll, and on these two issues, 28 and 29%, much fewer than that 44 back his positions on trade.
We'll leave it there for now. Charles, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Take care.
That's Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette University Law School poll, sharing some of the results from the survey, the latest survey released earlier today. Many sports require all kinds of specialized equipment or special fields or courts in order to play, but there's one competitive sport that just needs one item, a length of rope. Jumping rope has moved from a playground pastime to a competitive sport, and there's a team right here in the state that's competing this week on a national stage in Wisconsin Dells. Jalynn Ennis is the head coach of the Fond du Lac Cardinal Skippers, the state's, as far as we know, only competitive jump rope team. Jalynn, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, tell us a little bit about competitive jump rope. What happens? What are the competitions?
Sure. There's two sides of competitive jump rope. There's the freestyle side, which is when the jumpers do tricks. They create their own tricks on their own. They add a little gymnastic twist into their skills. And also with presentation, they have to be able to smile and work the floor to impress the judges, very similar to gymnastics, only with a jump rope. And then there is the speed side of the sport. So the team tries to jump as many jumps as they can, either individually in an allotted time frame or in a group, like a double Dutch setting.
And give us some background on the Fond du Lac Cardinal Skippers. Who's the team made up of?
Yeah, so right now our team is made up of 20 jumpers, all girls this year, although we always encourage boys to join teams as well. Several of the teams competing right now at nationals and at the world level have many guys that compete at our level as well. But yeah, our girls range from second grade all the way through college, and they all work together, which is really cool to watch happen throughout the season.
And I understand before you were a coach, you were a member of the team yourself.
Yes, I was. I was one of the originals that kind of started out as a guinea pig trying to learn from posters from our Phi Ed teacher on the walls. And then it kind of grew bigger. And we did shows throughout Wisconsin at various schools promoting Healthy Heart. And then we got into competitive jump rope. I was probably about 9 or 10 years old. And then grew into the national and world level after that. So I jumped for about 10 years, and then I had an 8-year leave of absence doing other things and then came back. Now this is my third year coaching.
Now, you mentioned Heart Healthy. I haven't done a lot of jump roping, but I've done enough to know it is a workout. This is something boxers do to help keep in shape. This is a serious endurance and stamina sport.
Oh, definitely. One of the events we do is called 3-minute speed, where the competitors jump as fast as they can in 3 minutes. The judges actually click only the right foot per jump because jumpers are jumping so fast. And it's equivalent to, well, we're told it's equivalent to running over a mile, but just in place with a jump rope. So, yeah, it's a very intense sport, but so good for your body.
How many jumps does somebody get in that 3-minute span?
Well, you know, it depends on the individual person.
The good ones.
We always, as a team, yeah, we shoot for over 300 for sure. And that's just the right foot, so it would be over 600 total jumps.
All right, yeah, I'm trying to count that out. That's a lot. That's a lot of jumps. And so the team goes on the road. There are national competitions. Right now, actually, you're taking time out from one in Wisconsin Dells. Talk about the competition you're at.
Yeah, it's going on right now. It just started this morning. And we are in the middle of our freestyle, single freestyle routine. So the girls are out there showing off their routines they've created. But, yeah, normally we're on the road, so it's really special that we can be in our home state for one this year. We traveled to a few regional competitions in Ohio and Indiana every March and April, and then we went to Florida for the World Championships last year, and we'll be back there in just a couple weeks again this year.
And I understand you're recruiting. You're always looking for more athletes in the Fond du Lac area to join the team?
Yes, always. We just had our tryouts for this coming season, but we can't encourage enough, even for anyone that wants to learn more about the sport or just get a few tips and tricks to learn about it. But we encourage everyone to come out and try out of all ages, not just school age groups.
Now, I imagine you'd like maybe a club closer to home that you could compete with. If somebody was thinking, hey, I want to start up a team elsewhere in Wisconsin, what would be your advice to help get things started?
Oh, definitely get in contact with me. We've got our own Facebook page, our own Instagram and Twitter page, the Cardinal Skippers, and we post a lot of things up there. But my email, my phone number is on there. We'd love to help out any team willing to start up their own team.
I want to get into the freestyle a little bit. You said it's like gymnastics. I imagine there's some choreography that goes into it. Is that something that the athlete does on their own? Do you help out? Who's the choreographer?
Yeah, for the most part, we create it all on our own. The girls kind of work together as a team to help create tricks. The cool thing about jump rope is nothing is set. Anything can be created on a daily basis as long as you're willing to figure out how to work the rope around your body. But also we go to workshops. We do a lot of workshops outside of the state, inside of the state. We also hold workshops at our home gym in Fond du Lac for local people that want to learn. It's kind of a create your own, but learn from others as well.
And this event you're at right now in Wisconsin Dells, is this the big one for the year, or are there other big competitions coming up too?
There's actually, right now, there's two organizations of jump rope. There's the USA Jump Rope Organization, and their big competition event is Nationals, which is being held now. So that's the one where all the teams from around the country come together to compete together. Today, there's 49 teams competing, so it's quite a good show here today. And then in 2 weeks is World Organization is hosting the World Competition down at University Central Florida. And we are competing against all different jump ropers from all around the world, which is awesome. There's going to be about 900 jumpers there.
I assume a lot of the focus is on exercise and fun. That said, are the Cardinal skippers pretty competitive in a lot of events?
Yeah, we like to compete. The great thing about the sport is everyone just wants to promote our sport. We wanted to spread the love of our sport and get it out there. So we like a good competition against teams, but we like to build great friendships with other teams as well.
Well, JoLynn, good luck to you and the team today.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us on.
That's JoLynn Ennis, head coach of the Fond du Lac Cardinal Skippers, a competitive jump rope team competing this week in a national tournament in Wisconsin Dells. She took some time away from the competition to talk to us. One of our most important social tasks could also be one of the most difficult, asking for help. Making that request can come with a feeling of awkwardness, even dread. Turns out, though, that people are more likely to lend a hand than we might think. Our next guest says that by avoiding some common mistakes and appealing to a few basic psychological needs, we can get the help we want and need and make those helping us feel better along the way. Heidi Grant is a social psychologist who studies the science of motivation and communication. She's the senior scientist for the Neuro Leadership Institute and author of the new book, Reinforcements: How to Get People to Help You. Heidi, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Rob.
Well, Heidi, I imagine a lot of people have thought, oh, it's hard to ask for help. Is that just me? And it turns out, no, it's our brains. It's part of being human. Can you talk about that?
Oh, sure. I think it's probably one of the most common experiences you can have. I was just at a conference where I asked a room full of about 2,000 people. I said, raise your hand if you've ever felt awkward asking for help. And all 2,000 hands shot up. It's really very normal to feel uncomfortable when we ask for help. And part of what I talk about in the book is that the reasons that we feel uncomfortable are based actually on a bunch of ways in which we think about help in the wrong way, or kind of myths that we buy into. One is that we think that other people will think less of us or will like us less if we ask them for their support. In fact, the research is really clear. People tend to like you more when they've given you help than when they haven't. So it actually is something that brings people together. It strengthens relationships. And in general, it's very satisfying for the help giver. We, again, often think about, you know, when we're asking for help, how difficult or effortful or unpleasant it will be for the person to help us. But in reality, again, what the research shows is that actually helping other people is something human beings are more or less wired to want to do. It's one of our most profound sources of well-being, of self-esteem, and positive mood. In fact, there's actually research that shows that, you know, it's really not about how much money you make or how much money you spend when it comes to making you happy. It's really about how you spend it. So money spent on other people, on gifts or charity, actually reliably leads to more happiness. And money you spend on yourself for gifts for yourself or paying your own sort of personal bills doesn't really predict happiness at all. So people are really wired to want to help. We We feel great when we help. We like people more when we've helped them. And we kind of forget this somehow when we are the ones who are in need of help. And what that leads us to do is really, really radically underestimate the chances that someone else will help us. So, you know, if you look across studies, in general, people underestimate by about half the odds that someone else will help them. So other people are twice as likely or more to help us than we think they'll be.
You write that there are right ways and wrong ways to go to people and ask for help. And I'm really sorry to ask you to explain this, but apologizing on the way in is a bad way, right?
It really is. So there's a whole part of the book where I call You Made It Weird, where, you know, it would have been fine if you had just asked for the help. The person was quite likely to give it to you and probably would have felt good about giving it. But there's all kinds of things we do sometimes that actually kind of ruin it for the help giver. And so one of them is over apologizing. You know, sometimes, again, we're the ones who feel awkward. We're asking for help. So we say things like, you know, oh, I'm so sorry. I feel so terrible for asking you. You must think it's so pathetic that I need your help. And we do all this stuff in a way to kind of make ourselves feel better because we feel so awkward. But all we're actually doing is sort of ruining the experience for the other person, making them uncomfortable. You know, it's hard to give, to enjoy giving help to someone who clearly feels so awful about having asked you for it in the first place. So apologizing is not necessary and doesn't help. Another thing that we do sometimes to try to increase the likelihood or the motivation of the other person to help us is that we offer some sort of reward, right? So instead of saying, you know, will you help me complete this project? I say, well, will you help me complete the project? If you do, I'll buy you lunch. And we feel like throwing in lunch is somehow going to make them more motivated, when in fact, it just changes the motivation. So originally, I could have felt like I was helping you because I'm a good person, I'm a good friend, I'm a good colleague, and that would have been very satisfying for me. Now I feel like I'm helping you for lunch, which now that sort of feels just like an exchange, which, you know, is the kind of thing that could happen between strangers, right? So if anything, it's sort of taking your relationship down a peg, that you feel like you have to reward me somehow for being a good colleague or a good friend. So sometimes we pile on these additional motivations, and that actually just sort of ruins it for the person who's on the receiving end.
Talking to Heidi Grant, author of Reinforcements, How to Get People to Help You. I want to ask for some individual advice for people who may have been where I was, you know, in high school and college, where there were academic advisors whose literal job was they were paid to help. And I thought, oh, I don't want to be a bother. I don't want to go ask them for help. So people in that boat, what would you say to them to say, you know, it is okay to go to someone and ask for help?
Oh, it's absolutely okay. I was one of those academic advisors for years. I was a university professor, and it was one of the more potentially rewarding things that I got to do. And I say potentially because there are a few things that can make it not very rewarding. And I think if you do these things, you're gonna be sure that you make it rewarding for that other person. One thing that's really important is that every help giver wants to feel effective. They want to see their help land. So it's really important to, when you go in and ask for someone's help, to do things like, you know, follow up with them, let them know how things turned out. Every year, professors, we have to write letters of recommendation for students that are graduating who are wanting to go on to graduate school or medical school or a job. And you know, it's a great thing to do, and we're happy to do it. But only a small fraction of those students ever think to come back and let us know what happened, right? You know, did you actually get into the program you wanted to? And every help giver, you know, that's when you feel really good. It's when you find out that the help you gave really had an impact. So I'd say, absolutely, go to those advisors. That's their job. They're going to feel good about doing their job. They're going to feel good about helping you. They really are going to get a rich reward from it. And just, you know, do whatever you can to really follow up and let them know the positive impact you had. And another group, by the way, that we completely underestimate are people who have rejected us for help in the past. So most people would rather do just about anything than go to someone who had turned down their request for help in the past. We do this because we assume, well, if you rejected me once, you're probably going to reject me again. Again, the research is really clear. The opposite is true. If someone has rejected you once, they're actually much more likely to help you the second time around. And that's because, again, people, you know, when we say no, we feel bad typically. So when you go to that person, you're giving them an opportunity to make up for having let you down the first time, and an opportunity to strengthen or repair the relationship that might have been damaged by having to reject you the first time. So, you know, a lot of times the things that hold us back, like you're saying, I don't want to inconvenience someone, or they rejected me, they're not going to help me. You know, these are actually our intuitions are just all wrong. And that's really why I wanted to write the book, to let people know, you know, the way we think about this stuff naturally, in many cases, it's the opposite that's true. People love to help. They want you to ask them for help. And they feel really, really good about it.
That's the individual level. How about a group? Let's say a workplace or a family. How do we create a culture where everybody knows, hey, you're not on your own. You can ask for help.
Well, I think it's really important to be very so there's a couple of answers to that. One is that there's research that shows, actually a colleague of mine at NYU, Jay Van Bavel, has done research showing that when there's some really cooperative people in a group who really publicly set that example of being, you know, kind of going out of their way to be helpful to others, it tends to actually be contagious, right? So you know, if you go out of your way to be helpful to others, chances are they will go out of their way to be helpful back to you and also to other people. Human beings are really reciprocal by nature. We not even always consciously, but we tend to treat others how we've been treated. So if you want to make sure that you're getting a lot of help, it's really great to just sort of be an enthusiastic helper of other people. And I think it's also important, you know, especially if you're a leader, like if you're a manager in an organization, somebody other people are looking up to and really influenced by, to be very public about when you need help, and how getting help from other people has benefited you. Again, that sets an expectation that asking for help is okay, that we all need help. The reality is we all do. I think no one really does isolated work anymore. Very few people do that. Most of us work in teams. Most of us need other people to reach the goals that we have in our careers and in our roles. So really getting help from other people is a day-to-day thing. And if we can just really, you know, again, if you're in a position of influence, be public about that. If you want other people to help you, help them first. And these things sort of then naturally create new ways of interacting with one another.
We're talking to social psychologist Heidi Grant. Her new book is called Reinforcements, How to Get People to Help You. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have difficulty asking people for help? Have you managed to turn that around and reach out to people, or do you avoid it as much as you possibly can? Are you in a workplace where you feel like you gotta go it alone, or do you feel like, hey, when somebody puts up the bat signal, other people come and help them out? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation with Heidi Grant, author of the new book, Reinforcements, How to Get People to Help You. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel comfortable reaching out to other people for help, or does it fill you with dread? Have you had trouble making that ask? And when people ask you for help, what makes you want to help them? What makes you feel like they're imposing? Do you ever feel that way? Or do you feel good when someone asks for your help and you are able to effectively help them? And do you have questions, maybe for advice for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Heidi, researching this, has this changed the way that you go about seeking help yourself?
Oh, absolutely. I was just like everyone else. I felt very, very uncomfortable asking for help. And one thing that you know, doing some of the background research on this, I realized that I did, that's again, a really common mistake, is that I would sometimes, you know, looking for help from a bunch of my colleagues, you know, or a bunch of people at one time, I'd send one of those group emails where I say, you know, here's the help I need. Can anybody help me with this? And you send it to 5, 10, 15 people all at the same time. and then nothing happens. You know, you're lucky if any of them even respond. And doing the research on this book, I learned why that's true. So there's something that psychologists call diffusion of responsibility. That basically, the more people that can help you in any situation, the less likely anyone is to, because no one understands in those moments whether or not they're the one that's supposed to help. You might feel like, well, somebody else on this email chain has probably responded to her by now and offered to help. I don't feel personally responsible because she just asked all of these people. So that's, I think, a really common mistake that a lot of us make. That, you know, I know why we do it. We do it because we're saving time, right? I'm going to ask all 15 people who might be able to help me. But your success rate is much higher if you send individual emails to those people, or even better, pick up a phone or ask them face to face. There's research that shows that you are 34 times more likely to get someone to say yes to your request for help if you ask in person rather than via email. It basically takes about 200 people via email to equal the success rate of asking 6 people in person. So, you know, there's some things we do. And again, this is one of those things where, you know, the email request feels more comfortable for us, you know, the asker, right? I feel, you know, I don't have to stand there and look at you while I'm asking for help. So it might feel a little bit less awkward, but it also feels less awkward for that person to say no. So, you know, again, that sort of, it might, that little discomfort you feel about the face-to-face request really pays off when you see how much higher the success rates are when we take the time to either ask someone in person or pick up a phone and have a live interaction when you're asking for help.
And maybe I should take a step back, because you give a kind of step-by-step way to ask for help. And this one I love. Step one, the helper needs to notice that you might need help. And I think a lot of people probably have had that feeling of, I feel a little aggrieved, like, can't people see I'm overwhelmed? I'm doing all this stuff. Why isn't anybody offering to help? Well, they may not notice, or they may think they'd be bugging you if you stepped in.
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of my favorite things to say, and everyone kind of always raises eyebrows, is, you know, if you're not getting the support you want, it's probably kind of your fault. And nobody likes to hear that. But what I mean by that is that there's things you're probably not doing. One of them is that you're probably assuming your need for help is obvious. And nothing could be further from the truth. We all pay attention mostly to what's happening to ourselves. We all, you know, don't notice everything that's happening around us. And people fall victim to what psychologists call the illusion of transparency. We all feel like our thoughts and feelings are obvious to other people. It's absolutely not the case. And so a lot of the time, we just fail to notice that someone might need our help because we're too busy thinking about other things. It doesn't come from selfishness. It doesn't come from unkindness. It just comes from being really kind of busy. Our brains can only manage so much. So direct requests for help are really important. And the other reason that you mentioned that a direct request is really important is that a lot of times someone might notice that you need help, but not be sure you want it.
Right.
And that's a big deal. If you've ever, you know, offered unsolicited help to someone who didn't want it and see how annoyed they get with you, you immediately learn to not do this. So that's one of the things I talk about in the book. It's so important to make those direct requests. We all wish that people would just magically help us, that they would know we needed help and they would know we wanted help, so we wouldn't have to put ourselves in that position. But the reality is, we really need to make explicit requests to specific people. And when we do, the success rates for getting that help are very, very high.
Let's bring in a caller to help out our conversation. Chris is with us in Darlington. Chris, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Chris?
Well, this has really been very interesting. What I run into is mostly on committee work, and I have people who will say, I can help from 2 to 3, or I can help from 4 to 5. You know, you can never get a group together because everybody's so busy. And lots of time when they do come, they just want to get it done and leave. You know, okay, I helped, I'm out of here. And so it's just easier to do it yourself.
Oh, I know how that feels, and I've felt that many times before. I think one of the things that you notice is that the people, when you need their help, they don't have 2 possible options. They actually have 3. One is that they can say no. And that's, again, very uncomfortable. People don't like to say no. It makes them feel like bad people. And then there's 2 versions of yes. there's the sort of the not so good yes, which is, yes, I'll do it, but I'm going to kind of do the bare minimum and I'm not really happy about it. And I'm not giving you my best. And I'm also not feeling that great. I'm not reaping those well-being and self-esteem benefits, right? Or there's the like enthusiastic yes. The yes, I really want to. I feel good about it. People give you their best and they feel really, really good. And the difference between those tends to be about sort of how about their motivation. And there's some things you can do to actually shift that a bit. And one of the most powerful things you can do, especially if it's like volunteer work, committee work, is to have help people to understand how important the work they're doing is. I'll just give you one quick example. There was a study that was done looking at people who were fundraisers, and they were volunteer fundraisers who were helping to raise money at a university for a scholarship. And what the researchers did in one, so most of the time, these people, they know they're raising money for scholarships. Yes, they know scholarships are important, but they didn't ever meet any of the scholarship recipients. They never saw the impact of their helping. And so for some of these people, they actually brought in a scholarship recipient who got to talk to them firsthand about how important the work was that they were doing and how what a difference it had made in his life. And what they saw in the month that followed, people doubled and tripled the amount of time they spent on the phone and more than doubled the amount of money that they raised after having that real experience of like, wow, what I'm doing really makes a difference. So wherever we can take the time to show people, you know, the work that you've done, the time that you've spent, the cooperation you've given has really had an impact. And this is everything we've achieved, and really drawing their attention to that can really help increase their motivation to cooperate with you more. And also make it, again, a lot more rewarding for them. You know, helping is this situation where it has the potential to be a win-win. We want the help, but we also want people to feel great about it. And sometimes that little bit of extra motivation by knowing what their impact was can make all the difference.
Chris, thanks for that call. In our last few moments, Heidi, let's flip things around and talk about the joy of being the helper. I understand if I have some complicated furniture to assemble, I should call you. How do you feel when you're able to effectively help out your friend that way?
You know, it's helping. I think we all know this. We've all had those moments of feeling really good about ourselves. What you see, again, from the research is that people have these lasting benefits of well-being. They like themselves more. So their ratings of self-esteem go up because they feel like, you know, I'm a good person. I'm a kind person. I'm a person that acts in accordance with my values. And you see, like I said, a lot of differences in mood. So, you know, there's research that shows that people in a good mood will tend to want to be helpful because they want to keep that good mood going. And people in a bad mood actually sometimes use being helpful to others as a way to lift their spirits. So I think, you know, the joy of helping is really tangible. In fact, there are very few things that make human beings, give them a greater sense of lasting happiness than help. There are very few things that give us greater connectedness to others and strengthen our relationships more. And so that's really, again, the point of the book is to sort of unleash all of these people out into the world who have been wanting help, have been wishing they had more help, and I'm giving you all permission. Please go and ask for that help, because you're going to make a lot of happy people in the world, including yourself.
It's a great place to leave it. Heidi, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
I've been talking to Heidi Grant, social psychologist. She's the author of the new book, Reinforcements: How to Get People to Help You. Still time for you to share your thoughts, maybe your experiences. Did you have that positive experience that Heidi was just talking about where you helped someone close to you, or maybe even a total stranger, and felt pretty good about it afterwards? You can let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page.